the Rights and Legal Department at the Yemeni Ansarullah Political Bureau issued its first human rights document that was issued about a week ago about brutal crimes committed by the Saudi U.S. aggression against Yemeni civilians. We have, it was, by the way, entitled Yemen's Hiroshima. The report included 4,133 documented massacres and bombing incidents in residential areas with details regarding the time and the place of their occurrences. Saudi Arabia has been stacking war crimes in Yemen for the past 6 years. Will Mohammed bin Salman and maybe his generals ever be brought to justice over these horrendous crimes? Do we have a chance against these people?
I think it's doubtful, and this is because international law is at an all-time low, and it's really receding year by year. The only person that's going to get justice from the international law system or end up in The Hague will be some African dictator that was probably installed by a Western power to begin with. Those are the only people you ever see showing up in The Hague, more or less. But so the bottom line is that what Saudi Arabia has done is guaranteeing bad blood between the neighbors on the Arabian Peninsula. And so you can't erase that. This is going to sow the seeds for potentially future conflicts. There needs to be a unilateral withdrawal on the side of Saudi Arabia and a cessation of hostilities. This is the only way that we're going to avert more humanitarian disaster. Everything besides that is just really going to be a protracted, painful conflict, unfortunately. And well, we'll see if the West is going to come in like a knight on a white horse to try to, you know, broker some sort of negotiations, but or some roadmap to peace. But at the end, I think it's too late for that.
Well, it seems that Biden is a bit in hot water whether to back Mohammed bin Salman or not. Sometimes he gives him a good word, sometimes three bad words in a row. But at the same time, Yemeni civilians are losing their lives. They're losing their lives from bombs falling on their heads, Western-made bombs. They're losing their lives from the famine created by Saudi Arabia with the help of the West. And at the same time, if the West thinks really that they're going to try and do anything to stop this without the consent of the Yemeni people, those same Yemenis that are still in control of swaths of land of their country that have been able to liberate the occupied parts of their country, then they are really on a wrong side here. They don't really understand Yemenis yet. I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We will be next talking about the Lebanese crisis of economy. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
For the past 19 months, Lebanon has been reeling from a wrenching economic crisis. By the time the crisis erupted in October in 2019, the economy was facing four extraordinary challenges: elevated public sector debt, a bankrupt banking sector, no economic growth, and the country was politically rudderless. Predicting how the crisis evolves from here is difficult. Lebanon's economic crisis, a tragedy in the making, in this following report. Lebanon's annual inflation rate reached a record high, and food prices soared by around 500% in February, highlighting the dramatic impact on consumers and businesses of the country's worst financial crisis in decades. With hindsight, Lebanon's economic crisis was predictable. By the time the crisis erupted in October 2019, the economy was already facing four extraordinary challenges. First, public sector debt had reached such elevated levels that a default had become a question of when, not if.
Second, the banking sector, having lent three-quarters of deposits to the government, had become functionally bankrupt and increasingly illiquid. Third, the productive economy had experienced virtually no growth for an entire decade, a development with acute socio-political implications. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the country was politically aimless. There was no president between 2014 and 2016. There were multiple and lengthy delays in cabinet formation, and the 2018 parliamentary elections took place, but only after a five-year delay. The Hariri government that was in place when the crisis hit in 2019 became impotent to such an extent that it lacked power to deliver on any of the reforms required as a condition for foreign support. By October 2019, the citizenry had had enough. Sensing a looming crisis and frustrated by the utter lack of action by the political class, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets demanding radical political change. The cabinet resigned, throwing the country into a political crisis. Unsurprisingly, capital inflows came to a sudden halt. Banks, already insolvent, experienced a sharp liquidity crunch, forcing them to declare a bank holiday and institute severe restrictions on bank withdrawals. A foreign exchange black market emerged, and the national currency, the lira, sharply depreciated. In return, inflation soared and people's real wages and purchasing power collapsed. In addition, as if all these woes aren't enough, a severe COVID-19 crisis hit the country, and most tragically, a devastating explosion took place on August 4, 2020, leveling a third of downtown Beirut. Human capital is fast eroding due to a massive brain drain of the young and skilled. Equally worrying is the loss of physical productive capacity resulting from widespread business closures. Much more alarming are the security consequences of the economic implosion. Lebanon's sectarian history is rife with conflict, and economic collapse provides a perfect habitat for a return of violence.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Nasri Harb, economist and dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Yuzal University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nasri Harb. Now, left to its own devices, the Lebanese economy will for sure generate an alarming acceleration of youth and skilled labor immigration. We have a lot of enterprises closing. The currency is becoming further unanchored. Hyperinflation is wiping the incomes of the public and their wealth. And we have now food and medical shortages that seem will only escalate. Which requires more level of humanitarian support, foreign humanitarian support. That is the worst case scenario, and I thought that we were already there. Could this become even worse now?
Okay, hi Marwa. I think there is no limit to how bad we can go. Let me tell you this, as long as the government does not take any action, things will worsen. The hyperinflation will fuel itself. As a number, we can cite two recent examples from two economies. In Venezuela, for instance, where inflation has reached about 65,000%.
Wow.
That is a 71% inflation every month, which means that your salary that you receive at the beginning of the month will lose 70% of its value at the end of the month. So you are left with only 30%. Another typical example is, a famous example is Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, in the peak of the hyperinflation, currency used to lose 98%, which is almost its whole value every day at the peak of the inflation. So there is no limit to how bad we can go.
That is a scary thought right there.
Indeed.
But there is one best case scenario for Lebanon that's being discussed all around now, is by starting with a cabinet. That should be giving some sort of a short-term stabilization program for the country, which involves tightening of liquidity, maybe arresting the fiscal implosion, maybe using capital control, especially on large amounts of money which are still being leaked out of the country, and maybe obtaining an urgent external bridge loan like that of the IMF. However, look, I understand all these points that we are speaking about, but wouldn't even more loans by the Lebanese be a burden for them rather than an actual escape from this reality?
Okay, the loan from the IMF, you can say it's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, from one side, it will call for more reform, it will help, and it will ask for discipline from the government. However, on the other hand, if there is no discipline, if the loan is not well negotiated, because the trend at the IMF is to follow more liberal action, reducing government size, and taking harsh action towards the harsh social action. So if it's not well negotiated, it may lead to further social problems.
You mean more privatization instead of actually maybe putting help towards the public institutions?
Exactly. So it takes like strong political action and strong political negotiation to negotiate a good terms for these loans. That's one. Two, if this loan is not well used, it will add to the burden of the country, like the debt to the country, like similar to what happened to Paris conferences. We have received aids and billions of dollars, and after all, it came out like as a burden on the country.
And our debt becomes $120 billion.
Exactly.
But the annual inflation rate, Dr. Harbi, is that it reached a high record, and the food prices soared. They are more than 500% this February 2021, highlighting the dramatic impact on both consumers and enterprises as well, especially because this is the worst economic crisis for at least two decades. How much longer do you think these businesses can withstand such a dramatic impact on them?
It's difficult to say, but however, the conditions are very harsh. If we can cite what are the problems faced by the businesses, it's unbelievable. You have one, reduced demand. People are poorer than before. Difficult investment because there is no exchange. Unstable exchange rate. You can start with a given price, and then at the end of the day, the price will be changed. Uncertainty, okay? You can never tell what to expect in the next day. Unmotivated employees, which will reduce the cost of production.
Mm-hmm.
You have also angry consumer, which will be very difficult to deal with. You have difficult financial transaction. If you want to export, if you want to import, how can I afford the exchange rate, okay? The cost of changing price is by itself, cost of changing price is huge.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, in some supermarket, like during, I think, German hyperinflation, 50% of the employees' time was on only changing prices. So
it's very costly for the enterprise.
So just changing prices takes like 50% of your resources. So
and the remaining 50% is now becoming a referee, trying to stop people from killing one another.
That's
but
true.
What are you saying represents a public call, Dr. Nasri, to all Lebanese decision makers, whether it is the prime minister designated one, the central bank governor, even the president of the republic as well? I personally do not see a glimmer of hope here. I'm a realist. But as an economist, what would be the first thing that you would do to try and salvage what is left of the economy in this country?
Okay. Well, we were speaking about that in a conference a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
What it takes at the beginning, first of all, like a political will. Okay. Once we have a political will, any action can help. It takes a multilateral plan. You have, first of all, of course, you have to have a sort of capital control. You have to and that's very important, to establish trust. So I would say trust, then trust, then trust. That's the first point. Capital control, restoration of banking sector, okay? And we can speak also about halting the money printing process, because this is the main cause of the inflation. Economical reforms and structural reforms. I can speak here about political reform and economical reform. Especially, like we can give an example, a simple example, which will be a good start, is to rebuild the electrical system for electrical sector. Rebuild it, okay. And an important one is to encourage import substituting industries,
mm-hmm.
because this is one of the main source of fleeing the currency.
You see, this is what we lack in Lebanon, Dr. Nasri. We should have someone like you to be Minister of Economy, and yet we are still fighting between one another which sect will get which ministry, which, by the way, puts me at a very depressed position as a Lebanese citizen, because I don't know whether tomorrow will be better or even 10 times worse. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nasri, Harab economist and Dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Izal University. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, it's an honor and a joy to have you with us again on today's episode of The Lantern, only from IOIB English Radio. Thank you so very much for being with us. Today I want to talk about something that's really a pretty sensitive topic, in the sense that it's sensitive because it's a little hard to detect. It's a little hard to pick out and to determine, but at the same time, it's very detrimental to a person's faith and their salvation in the hereafter. As human beings, as creatures of this material world, we have the love for certain material concepts instilled within us because it is the prerequisite of having a dominant aspect of our creation being material. What I'm trying to say is that even though we are multifaceted and we have a soul, and we have a body, we have a mind, some people might argue that the soul and the mind aren't separate, some people might argue that the mind and the body are not separate. Anyway, in any sense, we are very multi-dimensional creatures. And as strong as our spiritual aspect could be, and as some people might argue that our soul is what defines us, and I'm not disagreeing with that in any way, not today at least, we can't deny, however, that this world was the first dimension that we can consciously relate to. This world, this material world, is the first dimension that we consciously relate to and we consciously feel and we have total and full awareness of, right? And because of that, certain biological attachments, love, and desire toward this material world exists within us. We can't deny that either. However, it is religion's job and it is the teachings of the spiritual domain's job to help us regulate this love and attachment we have toward the material world, because if we don't, then it will be our doom. Okay? Let's listen to a very short, very interesting anecdote to get a better grasp of what I'm trying to say. Well, actually, no. Before we do that, one of the greatest loves we have toward this material world is the love of position, is the love of power. Let's listen to a short anecdote, a short, interesting anecdote to get a better idea of what I'm trying to say, and we're going to be right back.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to this program entitled Lantern. As usual, we have a nice story. Position has its value. Once upon a time, a goat was grazing near her master's cottage. All of a sudden, she saw green grass growing on the roof of the cottage. Deciding to enjoy it, she leaped onto the roof and started browsing the green shoots of the grass. Just then, a wolf came there and seeing the goat, his mouth started watering, but he was unable to get to the roof of the cottage, so he turned to go away to look for some other prey. The goat saw the wolf licking his chops, so she laughed in her sleeves and looked at him with jeering eyes. The wolf, being helpless, had to tolerate this mockery. While walking away, the wolf looked up and said, "Young lady, it's not you who is mocking at me, but it is the height at which you are standing. Your high position has given you your value."
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
There's a very interesting hadith from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that says, that basically explains the last thing that will exit the heart of a true believer is the love for power. What does this mean? Okay, as human beings, we have love toward our family, our possessions, our friends, our wealth, but most of all, we have a love toward position. The love toward position is more important than the love toward possession. When we have enough power, when we have a platform, when we have a status that people take notice of, a status that gives us a voice, a status that allows us to influence other people, it doesn't matter if we're not rich, it doesn't matter if we're not pretty, it doesn't matter if we don't have a family to back us up. If we have that status, if we have that power to control the people's minds and hearts, we have it all. We have it all. Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam was an orphan boy, spent most of his youth as a shepherd, taking sheep and goats and herds of the people of Mecca to the outskirts of the city for grazing. Sure, one would say that he was from the tribe of Quraysh and from the most prominent family of Quraysh was with Bani Hashim. He had a great reputation, he had his family to back him up, but still he was a little orphan boy. He was known as the orphan of Bani Hashim. He never met his father. His mother died at a young age. He wasn't filthy rich in any way. As a matter of fact, him marrying Sayyida Khadija, who was the billionaire of her time, was incapable to him of doing a lot of things that he otherwise would not have been able to do for Islam. But he had such control over the hearts and minds of people that he, 1400 years later, is one of the most famous, most well-known characters of history. Even if you take away that religious, spiritual aspect. Why? Because of that status. Sure, you might also say that that status was not, would have not been achieved was it not for Lady Khadija's money. Again, toward the end of Lady Khadija's life, none of that money was there anymore. They were sanctioned. They were in the valley of Abu Talib, and the entirety of the Muslim Ummah lived on a few pieces of date fruits. Rasulullah wasn't a wealthy human being, but he had that position. And as was Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam and Fatima al-Zahra, the position of being the daughter of Rasulullah, for most of her life, everyone respected her. Everyone looked up to her. I'm not saying that this is a bad thing. I'm saying it's a very important thing. And at the end of the day, that is the final state, the final level of love toward this world, these material things that any believer has to take out of his heart. The hadith says that it has to be taken out of a person's heart because, well, it doesn't last, does it? Of course, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, they had the position that they had because Allah is the one who gives izzah, who gives dignity and honor to the believers, as the Quran states. Of course, their position and the love that the human beings had toward them was because they were pious, because they were lovable human beings, they were infallible, they were generous, they were kind, they were compassionate, they were giving, they were forgiving, they were merciful, they were intelligent, they were knowledgeable, they were wise, and the list goes on and goes on and goes on. But the point of the matter is that it is through position, it is through status that things get done by a human being. Today, why is it that so many people are striving to become influencers? Because being able to have that position status to influence other people is power. And power is everything. Power over people's minds and heart means being able to control them, being able to determine their fate, being able to determine and direct them toward the course of life. Who doesn't want that? However, if that power is used in corrupt ways, if that power is used for corrupted means, that person will not gain anything in this world, nor the hereafter. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for being with us. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah who is Ar-Rahman.
Allah
who is Al-Mannan.
La ilaha illa.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In these series of shows, we are trying to ask and answer some doubts and misconceptions, which is usually being asked by different questioners. theological and Islamic issues. So for this series of shows, we have been inviting scholars and researchers from Qom Seminary Schools. Like always, we have Sheikh Murtada Karimi in the studio with us, and we shall start our questions with him. But before starting the discussion, I'd like to welcome Sheikh and say salam to Sheikh Murtada.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikhuna. The question of the day that we want to ask it from the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, is concerning the pornography or porn industry that is unfortunately one of the that is unfortunately becoming a prevalent industry in some of the developed countries, since it has a very clear and direct contradiction with Islamic teachings. So we received a question from a questioner that we want to pose it here and to see what can be an Islamic, let's say, perspective on the issue. Shahman, the question that was asked is that why is porn the biggest threat to mental health and human brain? And it is not something that actually wants to be inclusively asked in an Islamic environment, that everyone knows that pornography, that porn and the porn industry actually, the outcome of the porn industry is this great damage to the mental health and spirituality and also the human brain. And no one can doubt it, and it has been proved, and the scientific articles which has been written and actually defended the argument are available, and they can be read and actually analyzed. So we wanted to see what does Islam say in this regard. What is the viewpoint of Islam with regard to the pornography and the harms of porn on the soul of the human being? I would be glad to shed some light on this issue, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that Islam is a religion preaching the idea of modesty, Haya and Iffa, according to many verses of the Noble Book of Quran and many narrations. Muslims are asked by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to take care of their looks. Women especially are commanded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to wear hijab and not to wear clothes which are going to provoke the men. Also men need to take care of the clothes that they are wearing. So hijab is for both men and women.
Yeah.
Now, there are verses about that. There are many narrations about, the dangers of illegal looks, looking at non-mahram. So with that, the viewpoint of Islam regarding pornography is clear. I'm talking about the people who want to watch such videos. Islam says that it is absolutely forbidden for people to watch such videos and clips. For those people who are in this industry, the answer is clear that they are committing grave sins. The point is that according to some narrations, sometimes you only commit one sin and you would be punished for that very sin. But sometimes some people create some, negative sunnah or tradition. Also, some people create good sunnahs and traditions. It's been mentioned in the narrations that when a person passes away, he cannot continue increasing his good actions or his bad actions. But there are some exceptions. For example, if a person makes a good building, for example, a mosque or a hospital, as long as people are going to go there and take benefit from that building, he will be rewarded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he or she, of course. And the same is true about negative actions. Now, when it comes to pornography industry, first of all, to talk about those people who are involved in that industry, we can call it one of these negative sunnahs, the punishment of which will continue even after the death of the producers. So my point is that for those people who are engaged in the industry, they produce such, bad movies, as long as many as people who are going to watch the video and commit sins, they, the producers, they also have a share in the punishment. Even after death, as long as this video clip is there, people continue to watch it, they will be punished because they were the cause for, leading or rather misleading these people who are going to watch the videos. So, for those who are engaged in this industry, it's a very dangerous situation. You cannot imagine how many people are going to watch the video, and for that you will be punished. At the same time, if you produce a good movie, a good video clip, as many as the people who are going to take benefit from that, you will be rewarded, because it is like that building, it is like that mosque or hospital. People are going to continue taking benefit from that or being harmed by that.
Yes.
But we come to the people who are going to watch such videos. We have narrations in our books which tell us that people are encouraged to take care of their looks. First of all, looking at such movies is haram, and there is no doubt about the fact that the person would be punished. And second of all, some narrations also refer to the fact that there are harms in that for one's body and one's psyche. So it's not only a matter of, a religious verdict. No.
Mm.
When it comes to its effects, according to some narrations, it will lead some negative consequences when it comes to your body and your physical features, and also spiritual features and psychological features.
Yeah.
Let me share some narrations in this regard. For example, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, "An-nazratu ba'da an-nazra tazra'u fil qalb ash-shahwa." Look after look. It can be understood in two ways. We know that according to the religion of Islam, the first look is okay. If you are passing by some people and by chance you see a non-mahram lady who is not practicing hijab, so the first glance is halal because you did not have any role in that.
Yeah.
But you are not allowed to continue looking at non-mahram. So mm-hmm. An-nazra ba'da an-nazra may refer to that, look after look. Or it may refer to the repetition of this action, to look at illegal scenes many times. Tazra'u fil qalbi ash-shahwa. It grows the seed of lust in one person's heart.
Yeah.
And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, وَكَفَى بِهَا لِصَاحِبِهَا فِتْنَةً. This very fact that you have the tree of lust in your heart is enough for you to be a kind of fitna, a sedition, a great problem. Now, we can conclude even from this very narration that how dangerous is, illegal looks. It's been proved in today's science and psychology that people who are who get used to watching such videos, it will lead to some negative consequences even in regarding their brain. After narrating these narrations, inshallah, I will come to the statements of some great scholars, even non-Muslims, in this regard. So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam calls it a fitna. It's a big word to be used for this, so people should not take it lightly. It's a great problem and sedition for a person who is getting used to watch illegal and bad movies.
Very true.
The Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, "An-nazaru sahmun masmum min saham iblis." Nazar, look, which means looking at non-mahram and illegal videos, is a poisoned arrow of the arrows of the Satan.
But Shaykhna, one might say that since it is a video, something which has been recorded, and also so it is not a live scene to be looked at, so it does not, it might not be actually the addressee of these ahadith that you are reciting, Shaykhna. Is it true?
This is a good question, but the point is that, I mean, the jurists who they have issued the fatwa that it doesn't make any difference when it comes to, of course, there are some differences when it comes to seeing a non-mahram and seeing the picture of it. But we know that at least at the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, maybe painting has been there. And the scholars, they have referred to the verses and the narrations of the Quran to come to this conclusion that it doesn't make any difference. When it comes to watching videos which provoke your sexual desires, the narrations tell us that if anything provokes sexual desires in a person and it leads to committing a haram act like masturbation, for example, it is haram and it is forbidden. So the jurists who have issued this fatwa, it's not their personal idea. They have referred to the verses and narrations to come to this conclusion. Secondly, we see that the points which are mentioned in these narrations are applicable to both. I mean, as I mentioned, inshallah, I will mention the statements by the especially Western scholars talking about the negative consequences of illegal looks. The point is that what is mentioned by the infallible Imams and the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family regarding haram looks, it also includes watching videos. It's not only about looking at non-mahram, although at that time we did not have the concept of like pornography and making videos, but today we know that it is applicable to that as well. Let me share a few other narrations and then inshallah we'll go to the harms of watching porn to one's psyche and brain, as mentioned by some of the Western scholars.
Okay.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that كَمْ مِنْ نَزْرَةٍ أَوْرَثَتْ حَسْرَةً طَوِيلًا. Sometimes it is only one look, but it brings about a very long negative consequence. Many people, I think, can understand that sometimes watching one video can, I mean, mislead a person from the right path.
Very true.
Imam Ali alayhi salam refers to one of the psychological consequences of lowering the gaze. It is very interesting. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Man ghalla tarfahu araha qalba." A person who lowers his or her gaze, it doesn't make any difference if you are a lady or if you are a man. When you see an illegal scene, be it a non-mahram lady or an illegal, I mean, a bad movie, whatever, if you lower the gaze, if you do not watch, then you will have a more comfortable and calm heart. And heart in this narration may refer to a person's mind. And nowadays it is it is confirmed by science that people who are away from watching pornography, at the end of the day they have much more calm and comfortable life.
Very true.
We
are almost over.
So these are some of the narration in this regard. Inshallah I will refer to some points mentioned by Western scholars in the following session.
Thank you very much, dear Sheikh. So, all in all, whatever we have understood from explanations, watching or seeing or actually looking at any of these scenes or pictures is highly rejected by Islam and it's considered as haram. So, we all know that this is our duty to refrain from watching or seeing any of these pictures or movies, inshallah. Thank you very much, dear brothers and sisters, for staying tuned and listening to the show. والسلام عليكم.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن. إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن. لعلي وحسين وحسن. إن
في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
Aperture.
Depleted uranium made a spectacular entrance on the battlefront in 1991. During the first Persian Gulf War, bombs and shells made with this high-density metal annihilated Saddam Hussein's tanks. And since then, the U.S. military have regarded depleted uranium munitions as the magic weapon. For those who use it, depleted uranium is beyond reproach. But others say it is a deadly poison. So who's right and who's wrong? Many countries possess weapons based on depleted uranium, and experimentation has been rife. But the consequences for civilians and the military alike have been dramatic. Today's documentary, Depleted Uranium, a Very Presentable Killer, compares and contrasts the arguments of those who defend and attack a technology that is highly toxic. Stay with us for the first part.
It's a wonderful weapon. Depleted uranium is a very dense, hard metal. And you put it on the end of a bullet, or you put it on the end of a shell, and it'll go through a tank and go through the second tank. I mean, it's wonderful from a military standpoint.
Based on the fact that certain armies around the world are developing new armor plating capabilities, which can't be pierced other than by depleted uranium munitions, it's quite normal to conserve a high-level operational capability that the French army envisages equipping its Leclerc tanks with this type of munitions.
I was trying to say, hey guys, you may be creating a problem. I have been very careful not to accuse because, you know, j'accuse is a pretty strong thing to say to somebody.
My name is Jacques Charmelot. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've covered conflicts in Africa, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and in the Balkans. And I've worked in Washington, a secret and powerful city. On July the 4th, 2012, I'm in America's federal capital. I'm in the crowd attending the Independence Day parade. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm back from a battleground that the American soldiers have just left, Iraq. Barack Obama has put an end to more than 20 years of war-torn confrontation between the US and this distant country. But what I saw there is indelibly etched on my memory. trail of depleted uranium begins in Iraq. Iraq has been subjected to more than 50 years of revolutions, dictatorships, and wars. And it's trying with all its might to be reborn. But its poisoned past weighs heavy on the fate of 30 million Iraqi citizens. My investigation begins in Basra, a huge port caught between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In February 1991, it is at the heart of the international offensive to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. The Iraqi tanks want to leave the small emirate, but American planes, masters of guise, are waiting for them. I head for the scene of the Iraqi rout.
I took part in the war in Kuwait against the American forces.
Could you tell us about leaving Kuwait? How it happened for you?
I fought in the war up to the very end until the Iraqi army retreated, but it wasn't so much a retreat as every man for himself. The road was exposed and the planes bombarded our military forces. That was the situation with our tanks. The road was open and straight, and it was very easy for the Americans to bomb our tanks. It was this the road of death.
The final battle in the war lasted just 10 hours. Hundreds of tanks and vehicles were blown into shreds and abandoned in the desert. Much later, an official American document explains why the success was so devastating. On the road of death, American pilots used a newcomer to their weaponry arsenal. They fired thousands of rounds containing at least 320 tons of depleted uranium. The rounds are equipped with a depleted uranium arrowhead penetrator, which can pierce any armor plating. They catch fire on impact, reaching over 1,000 degrees, igniting the target and emitting a cloud of fine dust. They are real tank killers. Four countries are the main producers: the United States, Russia, China, and France. Natural uranium is used in numerous countries. Once enriched, it becomes highly radioactive and is used in atomic weapons and nuclear power stations. The residue of the enrichment process is called depleted uranium. It is weakly radioactive, but is not degradable. It has to be securely stored or recycled. 50,000 tons are produced around the world every year. In Basra, depleted uranium is accused of leaving a terrible legacy. I head for the city's central hospital.
Are you being treated?
Yes, I'm still being treated. Until God takes my soul. They diagnosed cancer in my pancreas and then my liver. You know, the countries that started the wars don't come to help us. They poured their poison on us and then they went away.
In 1991, the first Gulf War started, and at that time I was here on a duty at night duty, when the airplanes, fighters and bombs. After that, by many years, 3 or 4 years, we start to see many cases of cancer. If we compare it to the 80s or 90s, we found there is an increase of, say, fourfold. 1996, somebody came here with a delegation, escorting a delegation. He's from the security, and he knows about the problem, and he told me, "Doctor, you know that we are under the effects of depleted uranium, which is used by the American." Yeah, he just whispered into my ear that we got this problem. And so we start to have a link between the use of depleted uranium and the increased cancer rates. You know, now we have what we call a cancer phobia here among people. Everybody who got a mass, they think that we got a cancer.
Even before Dr. Jawad Al-Ali learnt about the dangers of depleted uranium, in 1995, the Americans produced a film alerting its own soldiers to the risks involved with the heavy metal.
Battlefields and fighting are by nature hazardous to your health.
some hazards are easy to identify and well understood. Soldiers recognize the serious hazards presented by incoming artillery shells and bullets and take appropriate actions. However, some lesser hazards from new technological applications are not so well known and recognized. One of these newer applications is the use of depleted uranium in munitions and equipment armor.
The film fixes three safety rules for dealing with potential depleted uranium contamination. Get away as far as possible, as quickly as possible, and avoid any exposure to the skin. Three rules that were impossible to respect in Basra. I discover one of the tank cemeteries that abound throughout the city. There are thousands of tons of debris, some of which contaminated by depleted uranium dust, have been accessible to the population here for 20 years. I'll ask the head of the Environment Ministry why such dangerous metal wasn't removed to safety.
After 1991, we had a full report on the sites and their effects. There was no department to deal with it. Every time we found a piece of contaminated metal, we identified it with a red or yellow tag. Before 2003, we put a notice, danger, contaminated fragment, do not approach. Shortly after, we'd return to the same place and the notices would have disappeared and we'd find them somewhere else. Even if we deemed it important at the time, it was only relatively important as the situation was very complex and local authorities had other concerns. Why did the Americans from 2003 and even since 1991 not remove or displace the metal waste? They did nothing at the time. The likely reason, in my view, is that they hadn't yet measured the effects of using this weaponry. They wanted to see the results and the effects after 5, 10, and 15 years, etc. God will decide. But the munitions they used against us will have effects on our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for generations to come, probably until the end of time.
During the invasion of Kuwait, Paris was a faithful ally of the USA, and French troops played a crucial role. I contact journalist Marie-Claude Dubin, who was at the front line.
There was a tank which looked all burnt up. And I said, can I go inside? It's not mine. No, it's not mine. You can go in. I raised up clouds of dust, and I never imagined that the ashes were mixed with depleted uranium dust.
What illness are you suffering from?
An autoimmune disease. I've been told it attacks the nerves, muscles, the thyroid, plus certain neurocognitive problems, neuromuscular lesions.
To get a clearer picture of what happened to Marie-Claude Dubin and to patients in the Basra hospital, I go to Valence to see a scientist. For years, Roland Desbordes has been speaking out against the risks of depleted uranium. He's the president of CRIRIDE.
We know that depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means that it ignites spontaneously in the air, with the oxygen in the air. A flameless combustion, but with oxidization, producing uranium oxide, which is an extremely fine dust that's released into the air. You can then be contaminated internally, either through inhalation, if you're not wearing a mask, or by ingestion, because it'll be on your fingers. The uranium combines many risks, but why? Because it's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation is what causes the most internal damage. Secondly, because it's a heavy metal, and we retain it. It metabolizes within the organism for many long years. For it to lose half its radioactivity, it takes 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years is the same age as planet Earth. These concerns over the harmful effects of depleted uranium dust are shared by official scientific bodies.
The problem is, in the case of internal contamination, either you ingest it because you're in a contaminated environment and it can be found in the water and in food, or you inhale, and the particles of depleted uranium reach your lungs. There are two phases to this. Firstly, the uranium particles have to be dissolved to get into the blood, and once they're in the bloodstream, they'll be distributed among the various organs. Once in the organs, either it builds up or it doesn't.
We often refer to the case of the Iraqi children who play in the tanks that were destroyed.